From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. You've probably heard one teenager accuse another of not being real or not keeping it real. When those kids are black, you might think you know what they mean, that they're talking about not acting white. But what if the accusation comes from a prominent African-American scholar, Michael Eric Dyson, and it's aimed at pop singer Justin Timberlake, or as Dyson likes to call him, Justin Timberfake? Well, then the conversation is about what some call racial authenticity, as in, are you being who you really are, as defined by race? So how does race define identity, and who determines what is real? John L. Jackson, Jr. is an assistant professor of anthropology and African-American studies at Duke University and the author of the new book, Real Black: Adventures in Racial Sincerity. It's actually Real Black: Adventures in Racial Sincerity. Although Real Black Adventures would be a fine title for this book. He joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I enjoy being here.
We are taking your calls as well, 877-962-9862. How does racial authenticity define you? Does it? Should it? What does it mean to keep it real? 877-962-9862. If you want to join us today on The State of Things, John, in the book, you take issue with the idea of, I used racial authenticity and sincerity interchangeably, but you really want to make a distinction here. What is it in your mind, and what should we know about that?
I mean, in some ways, I guess this is sort of the punchline of the book, is to try to figure out what authenticity, which is how we usually talk about the stakes of identity, can and cannot tell us about what people mean by things like keeping it real. And an example I don't use in the book, but I think it's a nice way to kind of ground the distinction for people, is a photograph, a photographic image. Because when you think about a photograph, you would never imagine characterizing it, I think, as sincere or insincere, right? It's an inanimate object, right? It's a thing. Now, you might think that the photographer could have been sincere or insincere when they took it. Maybe they doctored it in post-production. Maybe the people in the photograph are kind of, you know, misrepresenting themselves or, you know, doing something that, you know, doesn't do justice to who and what they really are. And we might imagine them to be sincere and sincere. But I would think the photograph itself doesn't have that capacity. I think the difference between how we talk about people, animate objects, and how we talk about things is really, for me, what authenticity, if it's the only way we think about identity, can't quite tease out for us, right? Authenticity imagines, I would argue, that race is this thing that kind of incarcerates us. It turns us into things, right? People talk, academics talk a lot about racial scripts, right? All we do is we read the scripts other people give us, scripts for what it means to be really black or really white or really anything. And so I think sincerity allows us to remember that we're not simply confined by other people's definitions. We're not those racial photographs, right? We're not inanimate things. I call it a kind of antiques roadshow model of identity, right? That someone else sort of plops us on a table and can then determine if we're real or not. I think sincerity reminds us that we're not just, say, 19th century candlesticks that other people can authenticate or deauthenticate, right? We're real human beings, and they wish they could see inside of us. Authenticity imagines they can use race to kind of pry us open and see what's inside. But sincerity, I think, just continues to flag for us the idea that there's something about who and what we are, that no matter how confident we may sound, no matter what truth serums we may use or lie detectors, we won't ultimately know. And it's that not knowing that I think gives us some purchase in sincerity. It makes it different from authenticity.
So if it's a script, we're not in read-only.
Exactly.
We can write this thing. We can edit.
We can improvise.
To what extent, when you think about a script, especially a racial script, you think about the dominant culture writing the play. They write the script, and then you live up to that. That's what you do. But then to a certain extent, you adopt it, and keeping it real becomes something that's important within the black community. Very important.
Definitely. And in some ways, I would think a lot of people would argue that the folks who police the scripts and how they're written and what kind of acts work and what acts don't work and what scenes can be written and what scenes can't aren't necessarily those outside a social group, but those within, right? It's policing from within. So I would argue these are scripts a lot of folks would think aren't simply the dominant narrative imposed on marginalized communities, but the scripts that so-called minority groups also reinforce and reproduce, right?
And why is that?
I mean, I think for a lot of reasons. I think one thing we like about categories like race and sex and ethnicity is they're quick shorthands, right? So, you know, because we're so afraid that we can't quite trust what the other person is telling us, right? We can't sort of look at their facial features, look at your gestures, hear what they're saying, and know ultimately if that really, truly, sincerely is what they believe. I think we like these other really nice shorthanded ways, these shortcut ways of trying to feel like we can be confident with what people tell us about who and what they are and what they feel like their connections are to us. So I think race is one of those categories. It means we can exhale a little bit, right? Because we think it tells us enough about this individual we maybe have never met before that can allow us to place them in a box that makes sense to us, that has social meaning.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join me and my guest, John Jackson Jr., the author of Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity. Rami is on the line from Cary. Hi, Rami.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I would just like to address your guest here. I'm a first-generation immigrant to the U.S., and I find that race is a very bad way to categorize any kind of people because, as being a first-generation immigrant, I've been displaced from my own culture, and I haven't betrayed my upbringing, but I haven't stayed true to what, you know, a Middle Eastern person might be portrayed as far as race. And I feel like if you use race as a measurement of, you know, how a person should act, that you just fuel stereotypes.
Well, let me ask you a question, Rami. You used two words. You haven't betrayed, you said, your heritage, but you're trying to be true to. And I wonder how important it is to you not to betray. I mean, that's a powerful word. And what it means to be true to that you're here in the United States and you're sort of not within the culture that you came from.
Well, I find, you know, I use those words because I do hear a lot of people, you know, especially when you go back to your original country, say things like that. I feel like there is no way I should act other than how I'm brought up, and I don't think race is the only determining factor, and I think that you shouldn't qualify it that way. I think it's maybe environment and family more so than race.
Thank you, Rami, for the call. Let me ask you, John Jackson, if those are identifiers, and they are very important things, that not being black enough can be a very serious charge in the black community, and it is considered in some quarters betrayal to act in certain ways. If Rami's right and race shouldn't be a marker, why is it such a powerful marker?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rami's absolutely right. I think the issue is all the other markers we would use in its place, like nationality, ethnicity, are also equally kind of jarbled and socially constituted. So I think, I mean, everything he says is absolutely true, right? We know, scientists have been telling us for the most part for the last 10, 15, 20 years, race is not a natural biological thing. But what I think I like about what Rami's allowing us to remember is it's not enough to say it's not real, because it still has real force. So the point of the book is say if race isn't real, if it's just our own kind of concoction around about the world and about identities and how we connect to one another, why do we hold on to it for dear life? And the book just tries to sort of talk about the irrationalities at the center of this category we hold on to so dearly.
Let's talk about some of the characters in your book. Let's start out with Bill, because there's a character who in many ways portrays some of the ideas and has a very serious idea, very clear idea about what it is to be black, and it's very important to him. So tell us a little bit about Bill.
Well, I like Bill because in some ways he epitomizes the irrationalities I just talked about. He's a street vendor in New York. His entire family vends with him on the sidewalk. They sell everything from books to watermelons. I mean, he's also a numerologist, as is his wife, who's an astrologist. And there's something about the way he looks, the way he examines the world that so epitomizes, I think, that weird mix between sort of hyper-rational categorizations of the world and these flights of fancy that race also needs to make it make sense. And so he's this person who I think I come back to time and time again in the book, not because what he says is accurate or necessarily true, but because there's something about the kind of oddness of some of the claims he makes about the world, right? I mean, for instance, he talks about how African Americans don't follow their destiny. They're following other people's destiny. He tells me actually I should quit working at Duke University and just sell books with him on the street, yeah, right? Because if I do that, I'm really going to be committed to the black community and not, you know, just following what white people tell you to do. Yeah. And he says this stuff partially, I think, because he means it, right? Because he sincerely would like me to sort of drop everything and come with him and sell books on the street in New York City. But I think also because he recognizes that there's something about this thing called racial community that is so sort of ineffable and hard to pin down that the only way he can get people to listen to him is to be provocative, is to push people on him, push their buttons. And so he's sort of this recurring character in the book that I think, I hope, pushes the reader's buttons and gets them to think about their own preconceptions about what race can and cannot be.
He is such a character and so eccentric. I wonder to what extent you think his ideas are representative, or how widely held those ideas are. And I understand that the reason he's in the book is, again, as you suggest, get you thinking about this sort of thing. Are his ideas somewhat representative, or representative of a substantial quarter?
I think they are. I have a lot of colleagues who now sort of playfully say I'm starting to specialize in the fringe of black culture. But I think the point is to say the fringe is never as fringe as you think, right? Mm. These are people mm-hmm. in conversation right. with folks you know. They work with you. You know, they go to school with you. He takes classes at Columbia to this day in philosophy and political science. And even the people who don't quite take him seriously respect the fact that he has an animancy. He's so committed to his project that, you know, he's going to be the kind of person that whether or not people agree, they're going to find a way to at least get him to weigh in on important events going on in contemporary black America. And I think in some ways, the way to understand a character like Bill isn't whether or not he represents all of black folks, but he does represent a way of thinking about blackness that other black people do listen to and take seriously.
This is The State of Things. Today we're talking with John Jackson, author of Real Black, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. If you want to check in and give us a call, we're talking about keeping it real and ethnic identity, racial identity. Keeping it real on The State of Things, you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about racial identity and racial sincerity, about keeping it real. John Jackson is a Duke professor and the author of Real Black. He's with us in the studio today, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Have you seen the effect of the pressure to keep it real on school kids? What's the effect of racial identity and keeping it real on you? 877-962-9862. Let's talk a little bit more about this business of the diversity, I guess, of what it means to keep it real or to be black. You know, I visited Poland once, and it, as I read your book, I thought about that visit, because everywhere I went in Poland, I would tell people I'd been to this city or that city, and they would all tell me, oh, that's not the real Poland. That's not, and so it turns out that nowhere was the real Poland, or everywhere was the real mm-hmm. Poland. And I get that sense, too, that everybody's got their sense of what it means to keep it real, and it's almost as there are as many opinions as those people you talked with.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, in some ways, that's why this call to keep it real is so powerful, because we never really get to the point where we can comfortably be satisfied with our realness, right? Well, you know, we're always trying to chase after something that's even more real, right? I mean, that's why in some ways a lot of academics think any invocation of the real is a horrible thing, and it's destructive, and it is, right? I mean, I think about sort of Morpheus in The Matrix, where he says, you know, he tells Neo, welcome to the desert of the real. And in some ways, that's how academics think about reality. Any invocation of the real is like a desert. It sucks everything that's useful and productive out of us and forces us to follow this phantom that doesn't really exist, right? But that we need, that we want to exist, because we think it'll animate us in a way that'll bring us to life.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, about the need to do that. You talk in the book about an experiment or a conference you went to, and there was a professor there who said, let's do an experiment, a little mind game. What if we lived in a world where we were utterly transparent, where we couldn't be anything but real? Could we stand it?
Yeah, I mean, would we even be human, right, is the point in the book, right? So, and in some ways, when I think about that experiment, I often use it in classes as well these days. You know, the first thing the students say is, well, first we'd have to know what we, in fact, believe ourselves. We have to be self-transparent, right? But if we were self-transparent, then transparent to other people, in some ways it'd be bliss, right? There'd be no miscommunication. We wouldn't be misunderstood. But in some really important ways, I would argue that this being human also means keeping secrets, right? And race is one of these ways in which we allow the keeping of secrets to be a window into a different way of understanding how we connect to other people. Because even though we may not know who and what they are, we still can use these racial categories as a way to think we have an ear to the ground of what that secret story is this other mm-hmm. person can tell us if we were able to listen closely enough.
So in that sense, then, these identities, these persona that we take on, whether they're individual or racial group identities, You talked about them being a desert and in some ways a prison, but can they also be transforming? Are they a stage? Are they a step to a kind of transformation that's much more creative than that?
I would say they are. I mean, I would say it's dangerous, right? I would say it can be very unwieldy to play with the fire that is race. But I do think in some ways it's one of the only things we have to build community. And I think if you're self-conscious about it, if you're self-critical about it, you can find a ways to build better and worse racialized communities, right? Better and worse ethnic communities. And I think if you're diligent, I mean, I would say we don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We want to attack racism and attack kind of overly essentialized and simplistic notions of race. But people have a connection to it. It's affective. It's emotional, right? And you can't just think it away. You can't theorize it away.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation with John Jackson, the author of Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity. Kelly is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Do you have a question for us?
I can hear you guys. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to make a comment about the something that the professor said earlier. I'm having a little problem here, you know, trying to grasp this here, because I personally believe I'm African-American, and I believe that the problem is, as far as bringing up this issue of keeping it real with our youth, is that they do not understand what that is. Is that I believe that we as black people here in America have been taken away from our culture, so trying to find out who we are has been very difficult. So now we take on these different things that identify us as being black, or be keeping it real, so to speak. And 9 times out of 10, those things are negative. Now, the professor makes some very good points on certain things, but as far as race, I believe that race is very important because it distinguishes us being different. The Creator had a reason for creating us different from being Asian, being white, from being Hindu, to being African, British, Scottish. There was a reason for that. And culture is what binds us, those individual groups, together. Now, the problem here in the United States is that why this issue of race is being brought up or so important is that out of means of one group being more or wanting to be more powerful than another group. You go to any other countries that race is not such of a big problem like it is here in the United States because of the ideology that is here in the United States concerning race.
All right, Kelly, well, I want to give John a chance to respond to that, and I thank you for your call. Thanks very much.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, if you want to imagine God as this benevolent being that gives us things. I think God has given us biological diversity, right? The question is, has God bequeathed to us racial categories? And does that biological diversity, that cultural diversity, graft neatly onto what we imagine to be racial difference? And I think if you examine it closely and critically, you have to say no, right? So I think I agree with the caller in every way, shape, and form, except at that point. I would simply say race is real as a political category, as a sociologically meaningful category, as a way to explain difference and power. But that isn't the same thing as saying race is natural, right? Race comes out of, you know, our genetic makeup, sort of whole cloth. We created this thing. Now we got to figure out what we're going to do with it. Right?
And it also strikes me that, I mean, the question too might be how flexible it is. I mean, there are certain contexts in which race is an important category and needs to be discussed as such, but you don't want to be locked into that.
Exactly. I mean, and one thing he also brought up that I think is really key is often generational differences between how racial, keeping it real, finds meaning, right? So often one of the big conflicts is between an older generation's notion of what it means to be really authentically black and the newer generation's version, right? And so I think hip-hop becomes one of these points where there's a lot of battle, right? And so we think often, well, young kids are bad because of this hip-hop influence. But I think hip-hop is doing for the older generation what their version of jazz did for the generation before them and what rock and roll did, right? I mean, I think in some ways we're always going to be at loggerheads about ultimately how we operationalize and express this thing we call race. But I think the point is, to be cognizant of the fact that what you believe is this kind of natural, isomorphic, obvious relationship between race and what people do in the world is really your own concoction. And we have to figure out together what the limits of that thing is and what the edges are.
And one of the things that some critics point out is that in hip-hop culture, the notion of keeping it real seems to be that which is over and against or not white. And so the critique would be that you need a white culture to be seen against, and it's not a true identity. It's not a personal identity. It's one that only exists in the face of a different culture.
Yeah, a lot of people would say, you know, race is this oppositional category in the U.S., yeah. right? You're defined against this other group. I mean, my only critique, my only criticism of a lot of the academics who work on education issues is that they would imagine getting an A in chemistry always means being white. And I would argue everything that goes on in the school building is racialized. The way you walk, the way you eat your food, what food you choose. So imagine to claim that simply what you do on a test is the only way people validate your identity doesn't understand just how dynamic and all-encompassing race actually is. It's always at stake. So you can do well in a particular class and do other versions of sort of racial identity performance and other aspects of what you do during your day in school and not have that A in physics or chemistry compromise your racial authenticity in the eyes of other folks. It's a juggle, but people do it.
Well, the other question it raises, if you think about Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying, I mean, there we have an inmate who is called an animal because by his defense attorney as a defense. He said, well, this man couldn't have been responsible for the murder because he's an animal. He doesn't have the intelligence. And so you get the inmate then acting out this, and the whole play becomes what is your humanity? And to a certain extent, if you're called a gangster and you say, well, if that's what you're going to call us, then that's how we're going to act. How does that, is that troubling in terms of how you define identity or racial identity?
I think it's one of the major pitfalls. I mean, race, if you hold on to a version of race that's too naturalized, that's too self-evident, it becomes a kind of puppet master, right? So it's pulling the strings. And you never quite know who's determining what racial authenticity should be, but you always know that you can tell what it is when you see it. And I think what I'm most optimistic about is that people really don't agree. They're always debating what it really means to be black. And I think those debates have to be emphasized as much as the fact that some people call on these very stereotypical notions of race when they want to talk about what's real.
I'm talking with John Jackson today, author of Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 877-962-9862, as David has done from Durham. Hello, David.
Yes, good morning, or good afternoon. Great program. I wanted to speak a little bit to the issues from the standpoint of a Mexican-American. I'm a second-generation Mexican-American, lived on the border, moved to the Carolinas a long time ago. And one of the things that I would say to what your guest was just saying is race can be a badge of pride, and it does not need to be a badge of exclusion. The way we handle it amongst the Mexican-Americans and other Hispanics is that when we're in the white man's world, the mainstream, economic mainstream, the political mainstream, we play by the rules of the mainstream. But as soon as we're in our world, we use our music, our jokes, our sense of humor, our traditions, our religion, our family values, to remind each other constantly of where we came from. And we do it with a lot of pride. And when we greet each other on the street, you know, if I go by and I see a bunch of my brothers are building a roof or mowing a lawn, I speak to them in Spanish. Mm. I congratulate them for the work they're doing. Mm. And we're very proud to be Mexican and succeeding in the white man's world. That's my point.
All right, David, thanks very much.
That's great. I mean, I think, you know, that everything about what the caller said is exactly part of what's so slippery about race. Because in some ways, what the caller was able to do quite poetically is to talk about Mexican-Americanness as though that's the weeness of race, right? So we would then have to ask the caller, well, how does that connect up to notions of Hispanicness and Latinoness, and how all-inclusive is this we, right? And then does race crisscross some of that, does skin color play with the notion of what the weeness of his Mexican-American identity is? I think it is a badge of honor for a lot of people, and we have to be careful about that. Right, because I think the badges often shine so shiny that they sometimes blur, blind us from seeing some of what is really pernicious about the ways in which we use those badges, even inadvertently, to distance other people from our sense of commonality and community.
Talk to us about some of the other things you found in your research. You talk about the community in Brooklyn that you call real Jews, and then there are black Jews, and certainly variety within that category. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, well, this is actually going to be hopefully a larger book-length project for me in the future on black Hebrews. But while I was doing research as a graduate student and then later on in New York City, I hooked up with this group of African Americans who imagine themselves to be descended from ancient Hebrew Israelites. So they read the Old Testament as their own history. And part of what that means is they would argue Africa has nothing to do with black folks in the United States, right? Africans are different peoples, right? And so what they would imagine is to understand contemporary black life, you have to link up African American identities in the present with ancient Israelite identities from the distant past. And what I found fascinating, there are two things I really thought were useful to think through about that group. One was that they were kind of black nationalists. They use race to ground their sense of identity, but without any recourse to Africa at all, not symbolically, not historically. Africans were different peoples and had nothing to do with their sense of what separated black folks from other people in the U.S. So I thought that was telling and informative. Then the second thing that was really fascinating was how they were able to reckon identity, who belonged in the black Jewish fold. And one thing they did I thought was really interesting was in the mid-1990s, they used a strict sort of genealogical equation. They said if a certain parent was black, right, and black meant Jewish, right, meant Hebrew, then you were Hebrew. So if it was a mixed race couple, it depends on if your mother was black or your father was black. And, you know, it doesn't matter how sincerely you believed you were connected to this group. If you didn't fit the equation properly, you couldn't be a member. 10 years later, they completely changed that. I would argue they kind of created a sincere model of identity, where the same group now says, not only can we not use genealogy to determine who can be a part of the group, who's really a black Hebrew, but now, you know, it's not even our point to judge. We're just going to let if they can feel the message, if they hear what we're saying, if they understand it and believe it, the example I use in the book is someone at a meeting saying, the person can look like George Bush. Right, and you would imagine George Bush for them is this sort of really demonized figure of difference. Right, the person can look like George Bush, but as long as the person hears the message and sincerely believes it, no one can say they can't be truly black Hebrew Israelite. So I just thought that was an interesting change, and it maps the difference between an authentic model that says, no, we look at your family tree and we'll determine, you know, if you can really be a member of this community versus, well, it's not even up to us to decide, right?
And it gets to something that Kelly said very early in the program, and to a certain extent what David is talking about, the notion that for African Americans to lose your identity, to lose the identity completely, a national identity, an African identity, then means to have to reconstruct an identity from whole cloth, unlike David, who can come over as a Mexican-American and sort of maintain a Latino identity. That's not taken from him. How does that difference, the African-American experience, how does that difference play into the creation of hip-hop culture and the notion of keeping it real today?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. One way we can begin to problematize that is just say there are a lot of different kinds of African Americans, right? We just had a conference at Duke on diasporas. And often the folks we imagine to be African American trace their own histories back through the Caribbean or Latin America or are more recent immigrants from Africa. So I think there's a complicated notion of what it even means to be African American that actually dovetails quite nicely with the Mexican American example. I think at the very same time, because a lot of African Americans imagine they have a connection to Africa that they can't localize. They don't know the tribe. They don't know the nation state. They don't know the ethnic group. That it's allowed the creation of these very symbolic notions of African communal belonging that I think have a lot of resonance in the black community. And hip-hop plays on that. And there are a lot of Afrocentric or conscious rappers that invoke Africa as a way to talk about their politics, their history, and the kind of connections between and among black community members.
Let's go back to the phones and Rebecca, who's on the line from Durham. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
You have a question for us?
Yes. I was just wondering if Professor Jackson could speak to what keeping it real means in the context of the biracial community. I'm biracial, and growing up, you know, I remember being aware of keeping it real very early. Even in elementary school, everything I was doing, how I was doing in school, my performance on tests, the way I was speaking, was very much watched by my peers and evaluated to sort of see, these are my African-American classmates, to see whether or not they would accept me as one of their own. And I was wondering if the professor could speak to what the role of keeping it real has played and will continue to play in the multiracial community as it continues to grow.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. Well, maybe I'll answer it by talking about another character from the book, a guy, Leo Felton, who is a mixed-race American, but he was notorious in the beginning of the 21st century, about 2002, 2003, because he was an African. He was mixed. His parents were kind of he called himself a kind of love child of the 1960s, black father, white mother. But he spent most of his life passing not just as white, but as a neo-Nazi skinhead. And passing meaning, you know, he spent his life beating up African Americans, going to jail for it. He actually got arrested in about, I think, 2003 for passing off fake bills at a Dunkin' Donuts, and he was using that money because he was planning to blow up Jewish landmarks, right? And this guy sort of made headlines, and everyone was fascinated in the story of an African American, quote unquote African American of mixed parentage, who knew that he was really black, but was passing as white, and not only passing as white, but really adamantly anti-black. And so a lot of folks would ask him, well, how can you reconcile the fact that, well, really, we would think of you as black, and you think of yourself as white? And he did this interesting thing that I also try to unpack a little bit in the book.
I tell you what we'll do. Hold on to that, and we'll come back and talk about Leo Felton and how he managed to reconcile this notion of race and become a neo-Nazi as we continue our discussion of race, racial identity, and keeping it real with author John Jackson. Just ahead, more of your calls at 877-962-9862 on The State of Things. Stay with us. Welcome back to The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about keeping it real, racial authenticity, or racial sincerity, as Duke professor and author John Jackson prefers. John Jackson is with me in the studio, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. And before the break, John, we were talking about Leo Felton, a mixed-race neo-Nazi in the Boston area.
Yeah, and Leo Felton was always asked how he could be a Nazi, be a neo-Nazi, be committed to that project, while at the same time recognizing that his father was black. And what he said, I thought quite interestingly, was, you know, race for him wasn't about materiality. It wasn't about biology. It wasn't about genes. It was about spirit. And he felt like he, in his heart of hearts, he was committed to whiteness, he said. And his notion of race wasn't about materialism. And so what I use that example in the book to just say is, it's not enough for us to imagine race isn't biologically real. Because he would tell you race isn't a biological fact. Even still, he used this concept and his connection to whiteness to justify attacks on African Americans and Jews and other folks in the U.S. who he wouldn't grant the same kind of flexibility, right?
Right.
These are folks who seem to be trapped in their material racial circumstance as he wasn't, right?
Yeah, because he identifies them strictly on
exactly.
skin color, and
exactly.
that's how he knows. But the other question it raises is whether or not cultural identity is so important that when you're mixed race biologically, he has to go the next mile to enforce one or the other. He chooses one and then really, you know, sort of puts the period on.
That's a great point. And he would tell you he was probably far more adamant and obnoxious about his particular commitments to racism than any of the folks he was with. And he said these people were caught up in, you know, their own notions of race, who he could never tell them his true history.
Yeah.
But he was always, he said, the person at the front of the line when it was time to do some really dastardly deeds.
So speaking of identities, in order for you to do this project, you adopted your own persona, Anthroman. tell us about that. It's a fascinating glimpse into the whole art of anthropology and how you get at this material.
Yeah, so Anthroman's a kind of academic superhero. and he's actually part of a whole community of superheroes called the Critical Front. We can talk about that some other time. And so what I used Anthroman to do two things. One is to sort of speak back to the assumptions often in the academy about African Americans, black public intellectuals especially, being asked to do these almost, you know, superhuman feats of explaining black culture to America, right?
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, tell us what the drums are saying kind of thing. And so Anthroman is one part that discussion about this kind of call for people to be, you know, super powerful in their analytical skills, but it's also about me trying to find a way to do research and often some really dangerous and uncomfortable locations, and it was an attempt for me to almost distance myself from what I was doing. Right? At first, I tried to pretend I was people like Zora Neale Hurston, or, you know, anthropologists of yore, Margaret Mead, and then I began to sort of take on this persona of Anthroman, which allowed me to be, in some ways, fearless when I talked to folks who often believed things that were radically different from what I believed and would sort of push me on a lot of what I took for granted about the world. And so Anthem Man is an attempt for me to sort of, one part, speak to this idea that we have to be these Herculean sort of super analysts on the one hand. And I think it also was a way for me to say, you know, how can I negotiate these spaces and still feel safe? It was a fiction I used to allow myself to feel safe.
But it's a subtext in itself in that it shows the importance of creating persona in order to get the job done. I mean, you've got a difficult task of, I mean, whenever you ask the question, you know, clearly people are articulating things that they don't normally think about. I mean, that's the problem for an anthropologist, mm-hmm. isn't it?
You're right. I think you're absolutely right. And in some ways, you know, since what we do is, we call it very technically deep, deep, deep hanging out, right, with folks. Often when you're doing that, and when I'm doing it as Anthem Man, some of what is really important for me is to try to think about all the different ways in which, you know, my own personas, the fictions I use to get the data, to get the facts right, are like the fictions we use with race, right? Race may not be real. It's this fictionalization, but it still has productive force. And so I think it's another analogy for just how important it is to not stop at the sort of final stop assumption that, well, since race isn't real, we can, you know, discard it, you know? There are a lot of ways in which we use fictions to tell us facts about the world and help us negotiate it.
877-962-9862. Let's go to the phones. Dave is on the line in Durham. Hi, Dave. Have a question?
Hi. Question and comment.
Sure.
As the author probably knows, the whole phrase "keeping it real" is really more of a hip hop phrase. It came out of hip hop, which was at that point a multicultural society, a multicultural subculture, and I think as a result, that definition needs to be kind of taken, needs to be looked at in that context, because as hip hop blew up and grew out and that sort of thing, the different races involved in it really take that phrase and a bunch of other hip hop type of phrases, and the definition becomes decentralized, really. And so I was wondering what he has to say about that, because
right,
originally it meant something kind of different, just being true to culture rather than anything in particular.
All right, let's get a thank you for the call, Dave.
Yeah, it is a great call. And I have one chapter specifically called Real MCs, which is about hip hop. And what I try to argue in the chapter is that hip hop MCs actually negotiate the difference between authenticity as a way to keep it real. And he's right to say it is a kind of hip-hop-based term, and sincerity as a way to keep it real. And again, the sort of conclusion I come to at the end of that chapter, which folks can tell me if they think makes sense given the evidence I use, is that hip-hop artists are doing both these things at the same time. You know, one part of what it means to be real in hip-hop is in some ways to fulfill the stereotyped assumptions other people have of what it means to be a real gangster, a real thug, a real hoodlum, right? 50 Cent in the new movie is a good example of how someone unfurls those assumptions. But then the other aspect of hip-hop I think is really, really amazing for us, and we have to hold on to it and think about it, is the hip-hop MCs are at their realest when they actually don't care what other people think, right? Well, they don't care what the stereotypes are, and they're going to do whatever they want to do, right? And 50 Cent is another great example mm-hmm. of this. And so, you know, I try to say these MCs are constantly kind of negotiating the very same binary that I think the book tries to unfold in other contexts. So it comes out of hip-hop, but it's not reducible to hip-hop, I think.
Well, the other thing it points to as well is the popularity of hip-hop and the way that culture has been adopted apart from race. I mean, certainly a lot of white suburban kids adopt all sorts of hip-hop dress, culture, language. And so it really isn't necessarily, you can keep it real, but it may not necessarily mean a racial identity anymore. And it's an international phenomenon. Let's go to the phones. Marcia is on the line from Martinsville. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, I just wanted to comment. I know y'all were talking about the different racial boundaries that we have in our society and culture today. I have a 2-year-old daughter in which I'm trying to raise the best I can is to not see any racial boundaries that apply, especially being from the South. You know, there's a lot of stigma that can be attached to the different races. I think it's important for us as a society to remember our cultures and our backgrounds, but to me, race isn't anything when it comes to the racial issues and some of the racism that exists. To me, it's just ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at that, and also ask if I can advance the question. And I want to thank you, Marcia, for that phone call. I mean, we're really not at a point where we can be colorblind,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a question. I guess part of what Marcia's getting at is, to what extent do we impose the script, and to what extent is the script self-imposed and authored and authenticated?
And I think I appreciate her motivation, right? I mean, we all want our kids to live in a world where the color of their skin isn't going to predetermine what's possible, how people react to them. I do think there's another aspect of this colorblind ideology that is also maybe a little bit dangerous. And that's the part that says, you know, that we can imagine, if we can find a way to see other people in this colorblind way, it doesn't even matter what they think about themselves, right? Mm. I think we have to be careful of that. Yeah. Because if people are invested in these identities, it can be really offensive for them to hear someone else say, well, they don't exist and I'm not going to see you that way. So I think it can cause different kinds of frictions if we just follow the colorblind script too straightforwardly. I think in some ways we want to, you know, maybe the best case scenario is we're all recognizing the fact that people have a lot of different dynamic identities they're playing with. And there are going to be some people who imagine themselves to be post-racial, right? That they don't live in a racialized mm-hmm. world. They don't see a racialized world. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to see that other people do. And I think you can't have it both ways. I think you can be colorblind, but you also have to be cognizant of how other people still use color and race, sometimes in really pernicious ways, to see the world and make sense of their place.
And other times, creative ways. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But it does strike me, too, that when we're talking about keeping it real, this real identity, it is to my eyes somewhat it is hyper masculine. Mm-hmm. And you even have an example in the book. You talk about Setapani? Mm-hmm. Is that how to pronounce the mm-hmm. restaurant, trendy restaurant in Harlem? Talk a little bit about that, and then the reaction of one of your the folks you talk to the restaurant.
Well, I mean, I think one way I usually try to explain this to folks who ask me about it is to say, to talk about realness and race means you have to truck in all the other important categories. Right. So what it means for someone like 50 Cent, for instance, to be real black is decidedly about also being a real man, right? Masculinity and gender constitutes that idea about blackness, right? And so I think, you know, all of these categories are, you know, really just placeholders for the sort of 10 billion other things we identify with that actually prop it up and make it make sense for us. In the example in the book, Setapani, there's a character who talks about it as a very classed space, right? It's a middle class, you know, location. So he knows poorer black folks go to other parts of Harlem to get their afternoon snacks. And he uses that to also say it's not just about class, but he imagines it to be almost this kind of sexualized space where he says if he were to go there, it would be like he would be a homosexual. And he actually draws on sexuality as another way to mark this complicated relationship between race, class, and sex. And so in the book, I try to say anytime people invoke blackness, invoke any of these categories, they're constantly dragging in the other ones, often, you know, to do some really horrible things with them. And again, separate the real Harlemites in that chapter's case from the folks who are fake, right? From the folks who don't really belong. And to be middle class, this one informant was saying, to be middle class and to be homosexual is to not be a real Harlemite.
877-962-9862 is the number to call to join the conversation with John Jackson, author of Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity. Gregory's on the line from Chapel Hill. Hi, Gregory.
Hey, how you guys doing? A lot of things come to my mind, but I want to comment about Bill Cosby, and that is, you know, Bill's got himself in a place of power, has been for a long time, but he used to star in a show opposite a guy, Robert Culp, who was a white man, and also, he's in power, so, you know, he's in a position to influence people. And the other thing I want to say, and I would like for you to comment to this, is mm-hmm. this thing I call cliffhanger syndrome around keeping it real. I'm hanging off of a cliff and a man passes by. It's at that moment, I don't really care who he is. I don't care. And if he offers his hand, I'm not going to say, well, no, that's okay. I think I'll just wait for somebody of my race or my religion to come and mm-hmm. save me. And so when you say keep it real, to me, that's about being real mm-hmm. and just trying to learn how to just transcend. I mean, I was one of the guys who was preaching racial purity. We shouldn't do it. We shouldn't mix race. But now, it's about coming full circle individually. I would like it if you could comment to that, please.
I like that idea of the cliffhanger syndrome. Maybe if we all kind of lived our lives every day like we were on that cliff. And we were so excited about any interaction that could help us from falling off. That might be a nice way to think about the world. I mean, I think the caller also does another good thing. I mean, people are constantly changing in the way, you know, the way they understand their relationship to race, right? So someone can go from being sort of a racial zealot, right, a racial nationalist on one end of the spectrum to someone who imagines they can talk, propagate this cliffhanger syndrome thesis. And people are all in between that.
One of the things, though, Gregory's call suggests is that if you're in a world where you can expect help from passersby, racial identity wouldn't be that important. But the idea of a racial identity may be more important in societies where the idea of the individual and you're on your own, pal.
I think you're right. Although I think, you know, if the social scientists got a hold of that scenario, what they would do is, you know, they would say the cliffhanger, if the cliffhanger is there long enough, they try to figure out what races are more likely to stop, right? So you know, think of all these ways in which we'd still truck it back in, right? We still find a way to think about race, even in that seemingly most sort of dangerous scenario.
Is it changing? Is there anything on the horizon that suggests to you that there is that this creative possibility, if it is that, is having a transforming effect?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think if we look at how race is being not just talked about every day on the ground in places like Harlem and Durham or anywhere else, but how the media is mobilizing and deploying race internationally, right? Every single day we wake up, race is doing something slightly different, right? So we have all these holdovers, the Bill Cosby's, who in some ways are imagining race, I think, in these really antiquated ways. But the young people especially are pushing the limits of that thing. And I think every time we wake up in the morning, there's a slightly different configuration about what realness is and what race is. And we have to run to keep up with it. And I hope that mostly it's going in a positive direction.
I think we have time for one more phone call. Let's go to Angela on the line from Durham. Hi, Angela.
I was just wondering, I have a couple of questions and then a comment. I'd like to know if you think that this is more ethnicity rather than a social or a sociological label of race. Because if we're distinguished or identified by the color of our skin rather than, say, our immigrated family members' heritage or our religious belief systems, does this play into the way that our belief system is reflected in our behavior?
I tell you what,
is
Angela,
that what we're looking at?
What I'm going to do is ask you, we'll limit it to one question since I'm just about out of time. But thank you for that, and we'll get an answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, the ethnicity race question is the $64,000 one, right? I mean, I think there are a lot of folks who would argue we should lump these things together, right? They're kind of related, and a lot of other people want to separate them. I do think the only way we can make sense of race is to keep it in a productive tension with things like ethnicity all the time. So there are ways in which, for instance, within the so-called African-American community, distinctions between Caribbeanness or Southerness versus Northerness become really important, other moments when they recede in importance. And I think if we think about these as complicatedly connected ways of negotiating the world, it's not whether race is more important than ethnicity or class or sex or anything else, but it's how do these things work at one and the same time? How do we keep that juggling act going? And why are we so committed to all the balls we have in the air, you know?
Yeah, and you talk about that in detail, especially in a place like Harlem where there's all kinds of new immigration, and that changes the dynamic.
Definitely.
Radically.
Well, and Durham, all this new immigration, right? I mean, Durham is changing radically, right?
And it has an impact. John Jackson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
John L. Jackson, Jr., Assistant Professor of Anthropology and African American Studies at Duke University, author of Real Black, Adventures in Racial Sincerity. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the program, you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.